Kalak iziz, çuvadar çez, vindai hubosta vingadar çez. Medis kari saidan kriz uaz rob zola nervs mishlis usikuo azri sashin lad vlis armin da brzola bivdi varshi usikuo azri sashin lad vlis armin da brzola metavedi brzola brzola Amboben rom esaris sitotsue Brzola, brzola Čem tviski aris Karieli jive, otahi da kive
My name is Brian Gigantino.
And I'm Sopo Japaridze. Welcome to Reimagining Soviet Georgia.
Today for our guest, we have Camille Neuville. Let's start. Why don't you introduce yourself? Who are you and what do you do?
Hi, Brian. Hi, Sopo. It's really nice to have this discussion with you. So I'm a PhD student in Strasbourg University, France, studying Russian and Soviet history. Actually, there's no such specialization in France. So I'm just like a student in contemporary history, actually, with a specialty in this area. And I'm in my fourth year of PhD now, in the process of writing. And my topic is the tea consumption and tea production in the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union.
Great. So could you just tell us a little bit about your project and your studies? Like, what exactly are you trying to research when it comes to tea production in the Russian Empire and in the Soviet Union, and specifically in the Caucasus, and more specifically in Georgia?
During my master's, I wanted to research border areas of the Russian Empire. That was my topic. And my first intent was working on the Black Sea region. And my supervisor, master's supervisor, told me, there's already like lots of gifted people who do research on the Black Sea region. Why don't you research the border with China, Sino-Russian border? And I was like, sure, let's see what the French diplomatic archives have in store. And I went to the archives and I came across this wonderful document about Russia's tea trade with China. It was so full of complexities and so full of like hidden geopolitical conflicts I had no idea about that I was immediately fascinated. And that's how I told my supervisor about it. And she was like, yeah, sure, that's a great idea. No one has written in French on the history of tea in Russia. And it's such a staple, you know, in the Russian diet and in the diet of many peoples of the former Russian Empire. You should definitely write about it. And so that's how I got started. And first I wrote about tea in Moscow specifically. And for my PhD thesis, I decided to enlarge the perspective. And what happened was, well, COVID happened, and then war in Ukraine happened. And so my access to the Russian archives was like no more. I mean, it was impossible for me to go to the archives in Russia. So I decided to focus on the Georgian side of my subject, which is actually very central because it is where tea was actually produced at some point, and it is still produced. And so I was actually very happy about this change of perspective because it allowed me to dwell more in the material aspects of my topic, like who produces the tea, who works on the plantations, and not only like who drinks it and what does it mean to drink it, like the more like cultural aspect of my subject. So yes, that's how I ended up actually going to tea plantations in Georgia to see how tea was cultivated there, and using the archives in Georgia, and also learning a bit of Georgian language, although I'm not very proficient yet. So that's pretty much it, like how I came to this subject.
Great. I think your research is like very fascinating and super interesting. I enjoyed reading the little bit that you sent me. And so I guess let's just start this somewhat chronologically. Like for our audience, could you just give an overview of the role of tea in not only the Russian Empire, but in the Imperial Caucasus? Like, could you just give us a rundown on like what was the role of tea both in the Russian Empire but also in the Caucasus during the imperial period?
So there's like several aspects to this question. The role of tea as an item of consumption has been widely studied, and the most prominent historian who's written on this is probably Sidney Mint. And like for his thesis is that tea in your Western Europe was one of the products that allowed capitalism to flourish, basically, because tea consumed with a lot of sugar was a very good food for workers, like for industrial workers. And like when tea got cheap and when it got accessible for most workers, that's when you can trace it, that's when it becomes crucial in European history. And the other aspect is like the role of tea as a product, as a product, not of consumption, but as like in the systems of production. And this is more important for history of China and history of India, like how the economy of tea plantations participated in the colonial economy in India, and how it participated in the transitional economy of China during the 19th and 20th centuries. And this is more what Andrew Liu studied. He wrote a fascinating book called Tea Wars. What I'm trying to approach in the Caucasus is more on the production side, like how this idea to plant tea in the Caucasus emerged, like who got this idea first and who tried to implement it. And for the first decades, it seems more to be like an aristocratical adventure. Like, well, this is what the Soviet history books about tea write about tea, is that it was an aristocratic game. Those not only Russian aristocrats, but also Georgian aristocrats, Armenian aristocrats. It was like very entertaining for them to, and challenging and entertaining to get those seeds from distant countries and try to acclimatize them around them in the Caucasus, where they had their lands. So that is this period in the history of Caucasus is we can date it to the like mid 19th century, like between the 1830s and 1850s, this phase, like aristocratic phase. For now, like I haven't found anything in my sources that could infirm this hypothesis that it was mainly an aristocratic pursuit, like the first tea plantations in the Caucasus. It had no real like it's I mean the metaphor is a bit silly, but tea didn't really take roots in the social system of the Caucasus until the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. That is for sure. It was it was mostly an aristocratic thing.
So this aristocratic drink, how does it become, a mass drink?
That is one of the aspects that I'm really eager to explore, is how it's like deep into the social fabric in this part of the Russian Empire and then of the Soviet Union. And also, I'm trying to figure out what tea did to the people and to the land, and what the people and the land did to tea, like to the plants, because it's also an aspect of my research. The first tea seeds that were imported to the Caucasus came from China. At some point, there was also an Indian variety that got imported because it was more frost resistant, which was quite crucial. And in the end, in the Soviet period, there was a hybrid local variety of tea that was developed. And so, it's a two-way interaction, two-way relationship between the plants and the landscape, the plant and the people, and the broader context. It's actually difficult to trace, in terms of the consumption of tea, it's actually difficult to trace exactly when it became a mass beverage, a democratic beverage in Georgia and in the Caucasus, because you have those imports table, like in Kafkaski Kalendar or the search sources, you have like the yearly imports of tea, how much tea was came to the region. You have also the like production of local tea, like how much tea was produced locally, but there's no way to actually relate this to what the people actually drank. I mean, like, it's just numbers. And also there's this aspect that there were local beverages that were way more popular than tea, that were also called tea, actually. There's this brusnichny chai, that was a tea surrogate that was widely consumed in the region. That's what all the agronomists and writers about tea mention, is that like the consumption of real tea from China in Georgia was not so widespread in the Russian Empire, because people drank more of this brusnichny chai, like tea from local plants. Actually, I know the name of the plant in Latin, but not in English. I'm realizing this. So there's no way to like, there's no like a certain way of saying, yeah, in like the precise, like, well, you can maybe you can have like average consumption per person. And well, the only thing that's really sure is that it completely collapses during World War I and the Civil War, and it takes a very long time to get back to pre-World War I levels.
So there's this imperial kind of aristocratic engagement with tea in the Russian Empire and in the Caucasus. And then you've got, of course, the Russian Civil War and the emergence of the Menshevik aligned social democrats in the Democratic Republic of Georgia from 1918 to 1921, and then you've got Sovietization. So like, how did tea production in the Caucasus transform and change under the Menshevik aligned government? And then we can lead that into how it Sovietization began to change not only the production of tea, but the role of tea in the development of this new political arrangement in the Soviet Union.
It's actually it's a great question, because it's actually a very fascinating period. First, there's this moment even before the emergence of the Georgian Democratic Republic. There's this moment when tea production is still going on and producing for the Russian Imperial Army, because that's who their main that were them their main clients, actually. And all of a sudden, like the tea orders from the Russian army, like cease completely, and the plantations and are kind of left to their own devices. And then there is the Turkish occupation of the Batumi region, and the Turks, like they apparently they pay no specific attention to tea production. There's like a whole like dark narrative that was forged during the Soviet period that the Turkish occupation was like a major period of oppression, imperialistic and backward oppression. From what I've seen in my sources, it's not like that horrible. Like the Turks did not actively destroy the plantation. It's more like they could not make sure that troops of demobilized soldiers would not go through the plantations and, like, you know, just not respect them, not actively destroy them, but not respect them. And then there was the British occupation, and the Brits were a bit more interested in the tea production for, well, for obvious reasons that they had their own domestic tea industry, and that they had, like, they had respect, like some kind of respect for this culture. I mean, that's what transpires in the documentation I've come across in the in the archives in Batumi, the Ajarin archives. And then the Georgian Democratic Government, it's they tried to like give some indications on the tea industry, like it would be good to repair the tea plantations, and also they get a lot of petitions and letters from the people involved in the tea business locally, who were like, please give us credits, give us assistance, and but they could not really respond to these demands. And whether they didn't have, like, there was a lack of like willingness to do it, or whether it was a lack of time or lack of means, I'm still like in the process of researching it. And then comes the Sovietization, and it takes actually quite a long time until there's a like a real project for the tea growing regions. It's not like the Soviets come and they like ta-dam, they have this wonderful master plan for the tea region. It takes a lot of time. There's a lot of negotiations between different actors that all have interests in the tea business. For instance, and like the agricultural economical institutions of Jaristan and of Abkhazia and of the Georgian, like the Georgian Soviet Republic, they're like negotiating between them, like they're negotiating, and they're like quite often struggling to have the best share in this new tea politics that is being implemented. And it's not until like 1925 that the party, like Bolshevik party, like takes a real interest in the tea growing industry, and actually like publishes a decree that, yeah, there should be a development in the tea industry, and that's how we're going to do it. And then they're implementing this new institution called Chai Gruzia, which is going to be like the main actor of the tea industry until at least the Second World War.
Yeah, you mentioned actually this woman in the paper you sent me, that her name was Ksenia Bakhtadze. And it was interesting because when you use this example of Ksenia Bakhtadze as kind of the preeminent Soviet Georgian tea specialist, you also mentioned that like she was an example of kind of social promotion and this like Soviet Georgian kind of like a national consolidation in some way through this industrialization and consolidation of tea production. in the in Soviet Georgia. And at the same time, you also kind of discussed how like there was a lot of small tea farmers in Soviet Georgia, and a lot of them were Georgians versus, say, the kind of Kurdish nomadic workers who were coming onto the tea plantations. And so one thing that I'm trying to, I guess, understand at least a little bit is like, what role did this Sovietization of tea production play in like the consolidation of a Soviet Georgia in the early period?
I think you could see it as like a consolidation that goes in different, like that goes both ways. Like there's a bottom up consolidation and the top bottom consolidation or something. Let's start with the bottom up consolidation. Like from what I've seen, like what differentiates the Soviet tea production from the imperial tea production is that like the workers, the tea workers, like the ones that actually there's like several steps in tea production, the more work consuming, I mean the more consuming ones are like managing the plantations in terms of like cutting the branches, taking care of the tea bushes, planting the tea bushes, terracing the land, like all these steps. There's also like all the tea plucking parts that is also very demanding in labor force, and all these tasks were performed mostly by a mix of like in imperial Soviet in imperial sorry in imperial Georgia. Most of these tasks were performed by a mix of local farmers, Ajarian farmers, or local Ajarian peasants that had no farms or no lands of their own or not enough to sustain themselves. So, like agricultural laborers, basically, and also these Kurdish nomadic groups that were present in Ajara, and also that's another aspect, groups of Pontic Greek women, mostly women actually, who were employed for tea plucking. So that's where. That's what the tea were like, the workers in the tea plantation looked like in terms of like national composition before the Soviet era. And it doesn't change dramatically at first. The most dramatic change is the disappearance of the Pontic Greek workers, because they all, most of them went back to what is now Turkey in 1923, following the exchange of populations between Greece and Turkey and Turkey and the Soviet Union. So there's a whole like there's a whole actually it's also it could be also considered like a top bottom manipulation of national groups as well, ethnic homogenization or something. What changes in the Soviet period, mostly from what I've seen, is that the workers are way more involved in the production in every stage of the production. Like there's a whole like there's propaganda campaigns to make them come to the technical reunions where they discuss the process of production and how to make it better and how to make it more productive. Like the workers are clearly invited and are welcome to come. Like there's this whole like politicization and responsibilization of workers. Also the like there's a whole like the politics of sedentarization for Kurdish workers that doesn't seem to really work actually. At least until the Second World War, like there's no like traces that it might have worked. And also they start recruiting a lot of seasonal workers from neighboring regions, especially Svan people. Spanuri people from the in the 1930s, when there's the collectivization drive, they often lack manpower during the planting and plucking season, and so they make all these people from come from Spanetia because they're considered to be good workers, and it's actually complementary with the Span economy. So whenever there's more time for the Span people, they have more time because there's a like the I mean, it's quite complementary in terms of yearly distribution of agricultural work. So they play on this complementarity of the Georgian regions. And workers and the technical cadres of the cadre of the tea industry. Also, now for the top to bottom consolidation, I would say that there's Xenia Bartadze is an example of the formation consolidation of a body of technical specialists that are specialists in the tea industry that are Georgian born, or Abkhazia born, or Migrelia born, and these people are trained in special institutions that are created by the Soviet regime, and that are for me, they're a part of this Karenizatsiya politics. That's how they're designed, and it actually works. And in Chai Gruzia, from the end of the 1920s until Second World War again, most of the leading specialists and people with responsibilities are Georgians, which was not the case before. In imperial Russia, there's very few Georgian specialists that are encountered on the tea plantations. So that's that's kind of a change.
You mentioned how in 1929 there was the creation of the All Union Research Scientific Institute of Tea and Subtropical Cultures, in order to investigate tea. And I'm curious, how did the creation of this institute sort of continue to transform Soviet tea production in the Georgian Soviet Socialist Republic? And then on top of that, I'm also curious if we could go into how the collectivization of tea production alongside collectivization in general in the Georgian Soviet Socialist Republic transformed tea production. And you kind of started to mention this idea that, the workers were very involved, that there was this successful Korenizatsiya process. And so, how did the tea production in Georgia sort of consolidate further this Soviet Georgian identity? Because it's very interesting how the Georgian nation builders, of course, in the Soviet period are looking to create a new Soviet identity in Georgia. And it's interesting how you have the Svan and Megrelians, people with whom in the imperial period had been kind of had local identities, and then through the production process are actually coming together in this Soviet Georgian production process. So I'm just wondering if you could touch on those.
So I would actually, I would be more cautious about the involvement of the workers in the production, because that's what they want. I mean, that's what Chai Gruzia, its specialists, and also the party activists that are in the region, that's what they want. That's what they try to do. But they're not always successful. There are reunions when almost no one shows up, or people show up but they don't speak, or people show up but they complain about other issues, and so it's frustrating for the tea industry specialists that are a bit distraught. So it's also a long process. About the national consolidation and the role of the tea institution, Well, this there's like a there's a big aspect of pride when this institute starts working, and it's it has this very avant-garde department of genetic selection, fetal like there's advanced plant science departments that are in line with what with all the scientific innovations that are taking place in Western Europe, in the United States, because the United States become the main reference in terms of tropical cultures, like all that all what they're trying to do in Florida, for instance, and on the Atlantic coast in Florida. It becomes this massive source of inspiration for Soviet and Georgian planners. And well, it's of course it's more well known for the decorative and urbanistic parts, and that's what sorry, I'm forgetting her name, but that's what's written on the Sochi and development of the touristic industry on the Black Sea coast. But for the tea industry, there's this this pride of like being on the same level, on the same technical, scientific, innovative level as the capitalistic world. There's also an element of local rivalry because there's a very similar institute in Sukhumi, in Abkhazia, actually. In the Abkhazian SSR, there's also an institute for the humid tropical zones. So it's the focus is a bit different. And this institute in Sukhum is a heritage of an institute that like a research station that existed. And that was already a rival of Batumi in the imperial period. So you see that the like these local rivalries, these inter-regional rivalries, they stay like on both sides of the 1917 divide, actually. And there's also an element, another element of pride, and this one is more. It has more to do with like marketing, I would say. I mean, even though it might seem a bit anachronistic, like the tea that is produced in Georgia, in Soviet Georgia, is marketed as Savietsky chai or Nash chai or and becomes Gruzinsky chai. And so it and also it's packaged in this boxes that have like that are in bilingual, of course, Russian and Georgian scripts, and there's a whole literature around like a whole visual culture that develops around Georgian tea that like really focuses on what is Georgian about the Georgian tea, like that really puts the focus on the terroir, like the specific characteristics of the soil, of the air, of the orography that allows tea to grow. And for me, that is that has had a deep effect, deep but hard to quantify effects on formation of a local Georgian, specifically Georgian identity. And also, like there's like a party politics aspect to it because tea production in Georgia was Lavrenti Beria's main pursuit. Like in the economic domain, in the economic realm, that was he was really trying to push forward.
Yeah, because he also did a lot of citrus fruits, like bringing in different citrus fruits and growing them and sort of trying to bring this agricultural new sort of trends in agriculture in Georgia. So I wanted to actually ask about that sort of, was it hand, go, went hand in hand with the citrus fruit productions?
Actually, that's also one thing I'm really interested in is how, like, where is tea located? I mean, in the different categories, like economical, administrative categories that are so that are so important for the Soviet project, because it's all about like managing the resources scientifically in a planned way. So you always have to like everything, I mean every object has its place. And like, what is the place of tea culture? Well, it depends on what you want to achieve, because at some points it is part of like a group of subtropical cultures, like subtropical plants of humid zones. And at some points it's more like part of agriculture as a whole. And then, but if it's grouped and if it's considered a branch of agriculture as a whole, it means that it has to compete with staple crops such as maize, wheat, whatever, like essential crops there are, like cereals, vegetables, whatever. And it's since tea is less, like it could be considered less important for human nutrition than these products, it means that it will have less, like tea plantations will have less space allocated and less credits allocated. So there's also an incentive to push forward the idea of a subtropical sub-specialization of Georgia. It's, I mean, it's more strategic for Georgian economic planners for how to have more credits coming, like more resources, more credit coming from the center, from Moscow. It was a better strategy apparently to consider tea as one branch of this humid subtropical agriculture that was so specific to Georgia, because one of the chronic problems in terms of agricultural planning and Georgian SSR, from what I've seen, is that there's a lack of arable land, like there's a lack of exploitable land. I mean, seen from the perspective of the planners, that might be interpreted in a different way if you think of if you think in ter like if you think in terms of daily survival of the peasants and of those like small landholders. There's probably enough land for everyone to use, like for pasture, for like this like not very highly technicized but very varied agriculture that is a mix of having some fruit trees, fruit trees, having some some grapes to make wine, having some cows. From what I've read in my sources, there is a major and well, there's a major conflict, tension, and it is not resolved. And I don't think it is even resolved yet between production of highly specialized production of subtropical crops such as tea and subsistence farming. It's just not compatible. And when you read the Soviet era sources, it's really, I mean, it's really hard not to see this opposition between like planners that are mostly located in cities and who have this overarching perspective on agriculture and the perspective of local people that are well concerned with their own survival and with their own lands, and that kind of like that are reluctant to adopt tea production because it's not essential for subsistence. I mean, in their worldview, it's not essential for subsistence. There is this conflict, and it kind of like blows up during the collectivization period.
But wait, who are the subsistence farmers? Like, who are the local people that you're referencing?
The ones I come across most frequently are the Ajarian and Gorian landholders. they end up being like having their land collectivized, but it doesn't seem to go without troubles. Basically, it's not like there's a lot of precise documents on that, but there's a lot of incidents. There's a lot of passive resistance. Like, they enter the kolkhoz and they participate, and their lands enter the kolkhoz with them, but they stop working on their lands, or they prefer to make money from reselling some products they get from other sources. They go to the bazaar and they sell them. There's like in the especially in the late 1920s, in the context of the new economic policy, there's a lot of such passive resistance that is like it is considered a threat by the like Soviet policymakers, that's for sure. But it's they're really having a hard time understanding why do the peasants why don't they want to participate in this wonderful tea industry that we are building, and why are they so eager to like spend their time going to the bazaar and selling their own production there? I mean, there's really a clash of rationalities there, I think, and it's interesting.
The reason I asked is because people like my great grandfather were dispossessed of their land during the Tsarist rule. So when you ask like who are these people who don't want to, you know, collectivize or even put their use of land towards the larger Georgian population, this is why I asked, because I know for sure my great grandfather and his brothers were dispossessed by landlords of their land. So he had to work in the city, so he had to become a worker because he no longer could be, he was not tied to the land, the land was not for him, like he was literally thrown off. So that's why I ask this, because it's important sometimes, because I don't know if it's like always peasants, right? Because peasants were dispossessed, a lot of them, they became the working class. Because I think a lot of times that's how a lot of these rhetoric goes, and I can say for sure for my family, that's just not true.
Yeah, I haven't really dwelled upon it, but there's a huge dispossession that occurs in the imperial period as well, especially after the conquest. There's no other way of calling it, the conquest of the Batumi region after the Russian-Turkish War in 1878. After this date, there's a whole of dispossession that is grounded in the fact that a lot of people fled, like a lot of Azerian people fled to the Ottoman Empire and left their lands, but they left but then went back, and there was this back and forth movement, and the Tsarist official could not really comprehend it, like they didn't want to understand it, and so they tried to facilitate the appropriation of these lands by individuals like colonists or private companies, and the tea industry also facilitated that. Like the presence of the tea industry was totally used as an argument in favor of colonization. So you could see in the beginning of the Soviet period, you could see this drive to implement a real popular tea industry in the region as a way of taking back the land and repossessing, taking back the land. But as soon as the collectivization drive happens, it's like the picture becomes less clear. And there's probably also a dimension of conflict within rural societies, like between the rich peasants, I mean, the rich or peasants that were at ease financially in the last years of the Russian Empire, beginning of the Soviet Union, and whose lands were taken in order to be collectivized and shared with lesser well-off peasants. There's probably an element of that. I mean, I've seen it in some cases, but it's hard to get a grasp, like a general grasp of how it was perceived.
You know, one question I had, and I'm not sure if you had gotten into this, is like, we know that in the early period of the Sovietization, especially after 1917, and then of course after 1921 in Georgia, that the revolutionary kind of radical approaches to science are taking hold among various sectors of like Soviet development. And I'm just curious, like we sort of started mentioning it earlier, but how did this new Soviet approach to, say, agriculture, understandings of the natural world, tea production, citrus, sort of affect the way that these tea institutes in Soviet Georgia approached the topic of tea? Because like I'm curious, like the role of this kind of revolutionary Marxist approaches to science and production were actually like affecting how these tea production and tea itself was being understood. Because we've talked a lot about like its role in production and the national consolidation, but like this scientific aspect.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, it's a major aspect, and I mean, it's even like the most crucial aspect, I would say. Like the fact that tea is an imported crop means that I mean, there's a whole artificiality to it as well from the start. There's the whole idea that, well, it, of course, the natural conditions for tea growing are do seem to be appropriate, but it didn't come on its own, you know. So there's a like ever even in the imperial period, there's a very scientific planificatory approach to it still. I mean, from the at least from the end of the 19th century on, what the Soviet science changes I think it's like there's a few crucial scientific thinkers that have influence on the tea culture. The major one is probably Vavilov, Nikolai Vavilov. He's like the he has this approach that's that when it, I mean, we, if you want it and if you put enough effort in it, then plants can grow kind of anywhere, basically. And so there's a whole drive like from the 1930s on. There's a like whole like effort to maximize the yields of the tea production and maximize the surfaces of tea production. And there are like some people do not agree with that, like even among the specialists in Chai Gruzia, but it's this perspective that like wins in the end, because it's the one that's at the moment most ideologically compatible, I guess. And the idea is like it's really based also on the like soil science and soil biology. Like, okay, we know that tea grows well on this red soils that are rich in mineral elements called lateritis. We know that in these parts of the Soviet Union there are soils that have lateritis in them, so we should blend them all with tea. Like the soil conditions are sufficient grounds to implement some type of culture rather than another type of culture. And this is a choice, like it's a way of seeing it, but it was not the only option. And so this I associate, I mean, I interpret it as like a translation of Vavilov's preeminence at that time. Also, one could see that one could interpret the fact that there's so much effort made in tea selection, like selection of grades of tea, selections of seeds, and hybridization of seeds and stuff. One could interpret it as an effect of Lysenkoism. Oh, I have a question for Sophie, actually. Because you mentioned that your family was dispossessed of their lands, and what regions, like where were they from, and where was it? I'm so curious about it.
But they were dispossessed from Racha, which is a mountainous area. I can't tell you exactly what year. The years seem to be very, very mixed, but I'm assuming like 1860s, something like that, 1870s, because my grandfather born in like late 1890s, I believe, around that time, because he's going to school around 1904, I think. But it's really, really interesting, this sort of, he talks about the life his father had to go through as a worker, where he had to sell his labor. And how he lists my great grandfather lists every single family that stole his land. Like he names all the names of all the landlords. That was like amazing. He's like, these people, it was like in the hands of a few families, the entire region, you know, like the sort of like oligarchs or, you know, billionaires now, like everything, you know, monopolists. So I will translate that and I'll send it to you. I want to make it available for everyone in case anybody wants to use it, because it's a really interesting sort of reflection on pre-Soviet Union.
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, all these land questions are, I mean, they're so crucial, and there's it's so complicated. Like in the Batumi region, there are instances when the Russian state does not support Russian colonists in their grabbing of indigenous lands. Like the Russian colonists, they go and they buy some land, like directly, like sometimes directly from like village societies or from the families. And actually, it turns out that the Ottoman property, like land property titles, are still valid, and so the people come back and take back their lands. And so the Russian colonists appeal to the Russian state, like, oh, we had this land, we had this like proof of like the fact that we bought the land. They came back and they took their land back. And the Russian state is like, sorry, we cannot do anything. They have an official Ottoman document. So it's like this, you know, the states, like the Russian state is like upholding the legality of the Ottoman Empire and the Ottoman state. And like this legality of the Ottoman state is superior to the legitimacy of Russian colonists. So for like that was there's many such cases, so it's quite interesting. And there is also a series of articles that complain about the fact that there are tea pioneers in the region of Batumi. Like there's this tea merchant called Popov who creates a plantation in the region. And he has trouble acquiring land and acquiring land that he can put to use because of this land title questions. And there's a few articles in Kafkaz that complain about this, and that like the Russian state is putting obstacles on the path to economic modernization of the region because the tea capitalists cannot implement their industry there. So it's, yeah, it's really complex, and it's there's a Yeah, there's in this whole like history of tea, there's very few instances when like oppositions are like really simple to understand.
It's very interesting. I mean, also, of course, you have this history of the Russian Empire banishing certain prisoners to the Caucasus. So of course there's like actually this tension between Moscow and the people that they've banished to the Caucasus, who then have their own complex set of relations with the locals. And you can't actually say that they're colonists in some sort of traditional sense because they're actually in tension with the center of the Russian Empire. It's not, of course, not exactly the same, but it's similar in how in the American colonies, right, when people were actually trying to colonize indigenous land, they were having tensions with the colonial authorities and the British authorities, depending on whose interests said colonization would serve. So I'm not really surprised to hear about the fact that this was like manifesting in the tea growing regions also. Obviously these are different people, but I mean, just mean that there's these tensions between sort of like people who claim themselves to be part of the empire doing things without without approval. So very interesting.
Yeah, it's a history that's full of contradictions. So that's what is interesting. When my research ends, there's right before the onset of the Second World War, well, right before it actually impacts the tea lands, you have a tea industry that is already like it was, that is in the process of being consolidated. There's a body of specialists that are not all of them, but most of them are also party activists and participate in party politics, and that is a major that can be a major problem because it means that with the purges, there's a lot of turnover in the direction of Chai Gruzia, and there is a lot of inter-institutional strife. A strife for like resources, a strife for having the ear of Stalin and Beria, like who gets to be close to the leaders. And this is a major problem between the different levels of party structures, between the different scientific institutions that I've mentioned, between the Abkhazian one and the one that gets created in Anatoly, close to Azurgeti. So there's this whole and this is a major fragility of the whole tea industry. The fact that there's this instability within the direction. And another source of fragility that I've identified has to do with the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, tea culture, the contradiction between developing tea culture and developing a subsistence agriculture based on staple crops, cereals, like this tension is still not really resolved at that time, like before the Second World War. And so for many land workers, agricultural workers that are involved, it's a matter of do I put my energy in the tea culture and try to become a Stakhanovist tea cultivator or a Stakhanovist tea plucker? Do I need this also symbolic recognition that comes with very material advantages when you're a Stakhanovist? You get prices, you get money, you get sometimes you get machinery. So like, do I participate in that, or do I try to survive in a different way, tilling my own land, having my own crops that I like sell on the black market? And so it's a matter of choices that are made by individuals, that are made by groups as well. And this is really hard to trace if you don't go to the like local level of the Soviet village Soviets these daily negotiations between participation in the Soviet system, survival, and subsistence agriculture. Yep. Because there's a, I mean, there's a, like the alternative means something, because there were dysfunctionings in the supply system that meant that sometimes if you didn't grow your own maize or your own wheat, you didn't have any bread, because there were problems in the distributional system, allocation of food and procurement managed by the Soviet system. So yeah, I mean, it's difficult. It's difficult choices, and yeah, that's how I would I would leave this here. Like, what would you do if you were if you were a rural Georgian person in living in the tier regions in the 1930s?
მეგობარი ფაბარი აფერადებს სახს იმედის ფარი საიდან ქრის სიმართლის ფესვებს დრო ვერ წაშლის ქალაქი ზის ჩუმად არჩევს ვინ დაიღუპავს და ვინ გადარჩევს ის დაიღუპა ის გადარჩა მე გადავჭი და დარჩა ცარიელი ჯიბე ოთახი და კიბე ცოცხალი ვარ ისევ ვინ უგეშენთავს დაბიღავი გუში ქუჩაში მიკითხეთ დაუტოვე ძვალი მაწანწალა გზავს ბრძოლა ბრძოლა ამბობენ რომ ეს არის სიცოცხლე ბრძოლა ბრძოლა ჩემთვის კი არის დარიელი ჯიბე ოთახი და კიბე ცოცხალი ვარ ისე ვინ უგეშენ თავს დაღიღარი გუში ქუჩაში ვიკითხე დაუტოვე ძვალი მაწანწალა ძავს ცარიელი ჯიბე ოთახი და კიბე მეგობარი მხატვარი აფერადებს სახს